This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Welcome to the Keynes Seminar. For those of you who haven't met me before, my name's Mark Hayes. I'm the Fellow in Economics here at Robinson. And tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome as our main speaker, Guglielmo Forges d'Avanzati. Together with his co-author, Rosario Patalano, Guglielmo is Associate Professor in the History of Economic Thought at the University of Salento in Lecce, at the very far end of Italy from Cambridge. He's contributed several working papers to PKSG over the last few years, and I'm very glad to be able to welcome him at last to present one of them, or a variation on one of them, to the seminar in person. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here.
Well, thank you for your invitation, and particularly to Mark for his invitation. This is a very preliminary draft written with Andrea Pacella and Rosario Patalano, who is here. And the title is on Keynes and the Monetary Theory of Production, also named the monetary theory, the monetary circuit approach. The aim of this paper is threefold. First, I will present the basic schema of the monetary theory of production as elaborated by Augusto Graziani, starting from the 70s in Italy, by emphasizing some unsettled questions. Note that Graziani is considered as a pioneer of this line of research, with further developed within the theoretical frameworks of Marxism, institutionalism, and Keynesianism. The second aim of this paper is to explore the elements of affinities and divergences between the basic schema of the monetary theory of production as presented by Graziani in his papers and books, and Keynes' thought, with both reference to the Treatise of Money and the General Theory. The third aim of the paper is to present a very preliminary theoretical macroeconomic model, aiming at inserting some fundamental Keynesian thesis of the general theory into the theoretical framework of the monetary theory of production, with particular reference to the role of expectations, uncertainty, and aggregate demand in determining the path of employment and unemployment. So I will start with the description of the basic schema of the monetary theory of production. I mean the basic schema to intend the pioneer contributions by Augusto Graziani starting from 30 years ago. The basic idea is that the basic assumptions are the following. First, money supply is endogenous and demand determinate. Is endogenous in the sense that credit supply is, according to Graziani, is a function of credit demand, while the demand of credit solely serves to firms to pay wages. According to Graziani, this is an important question in the sense that transactions among firms do not require additional influx of money, and therefore, as a consequence, firms need liquidity from need credit from bank only for the aim to pay wages to workers. The second assumption is that income distribution do not reflect the marginalist rules. The third assumption is that the unitary money wage is a given in the sense that it is settled on the bargaining in the labor market between firms and workers, and it is advanced, that is, it is paid before the end of the production process, which is the same thing. It is paid at the beginning of the production process. Since money supply is endogenous, this means that money is not a scarce resource. And as a consequence, this means also that labor is not required to produce money. The real wage, since the money wage are paid before, at the beginning of the production process, the real wage is known ex post, once the price level is determined. Graziani intend describe the functioning of a credit economy with according to a sequential process, which start with the bargaining in the labor market. On the basis on the money wage bill, firms demand credit to banks, so that the amount of credit demanded for firms to bank equals the money wage bill. Then the production process starts. Graziani assumes, I will not assume this. Graziani assumes that banks are perfectly accommodant in the sense that they do firms exactly what firms require, demand, and the production process starts, and the monetary circuit ends with the reimbursement of debt, what Graziani calls the destruction of money, in the sense that the debt is solved. A brief sketch on the basic element of his model. Graziani assumes that the aggregate supply is show costs and returns with only labor, that aggregate demand is given by the demand for consumption good plus the demand for investment goods. Note that B is the propensity to invest on the part of capitalist, A is labor productivity assumed as a given. The level of employment is decided on the basis of firms' planned investment, so that at the intersection between aggregate demand and aggregate supply in the point of effective demand, the equilibrium price level is determined, and it is equal to the unitary cost of labor, that is the unitary money wage divided for labor productivity, multiplied for the propensity to consume, divided for 1 minus the minus B, which is the propensity to invest. The detailed algebra, the details are in the paper. As a result, net profits become, on the aggregate level and in monetary terms, become negative. This is because, starting from the assumption that firms require credit only to pay wages, and second, internal transactions, internal exchanges, between the macro sector firms do not require further liquidity, further credit, it results that the money wage bill is at the same time a source of revenue and a monetary cost for firms as a whole. Therefore, if in the best case for firms, that is, in the case where workers have the unitary propensity to consume, workers spend all their money wages, but at the same time the money wage bill is a cost, therefore profit net of interest are zero, since the interest rate, which is considered in this theoretical framework a tax of profits, this is an expression of Graziani, by inserting the debt of firms toward the banking system, net profits become negative. This is the so-called paradox of profits, which means that firms in the aggregate are not able to obtain profits in money. Graziani's solutions are to, first, firms make profits in kind. That is, they produce more than what they sell to workers, and the residual is their profits, and they pay interest in kind to banks. The second solution is that firms remain indebted toward banks according to what Graziani names a normal degree of indebtedness. There are other solutions apart from Graziani, which we divided in internal solution, so to say, an external solution. That is, internal solution, if you conceive the paradox of profit as a logical puzzle, therefore you must find a solution which is internal to the production process. And the most relevant solutions are those proposed by some Italian scholars in particular. The first idea is that if you divide the firm sector in small firm and grid firms, so you divide the firm sector according, you make heterogeneous firms, the bankruptcy of the smaller firms, since money are advanced, allows the biggest firms to obtain extra revenues, which implies positive net and gross profits. Two more internal solutions is to admit that velocity of circulation is higher than one, or that the multiplier effect is in operation. External solution refers to other influxes of money, and they can derive from external trade, from consumer credit, and for public expenditure. This solution is particularly explored by Marxist scholars in the sense that they interpreted the paradox of profit as the problem of capitalist monetary reproduction. In the sense, they argue, they maintain that the capitalist system always need a further influx of money. A completely deregulated capitalist system goes necessarily, according to their view, in a condition where the where profits, where firms in the aggregate go negative profits. So, equation 4.1 shows that under the best condition, that the propensity to consume equals to 1, profits are negative. Consider that if the propensity to consume is less than 1, of course, the money wage bill, WN, is always a cost, it is WN, while the money revenue are CWN, which is lower than WN. So, as the propensity to consume on the part of workers declines, profits declines. Of course, even if the interest rate increases, profit declines. Left in as exogenous as given, the price level, the unitary money wage and labor productivity. We attempt to analyze the links between this very basic schema, and Keynes' thought, and we find this very, according to my view, very weak argument. First, as regard to the links between the monetary theory of production and the treatise on money, as in Graziani's view, the producer sovereignty holds, in the sense that to Graziani are firms as a whole who decide the scale and the composition of output. And this is an argument which is put forward by Keynes in the Treatise on Money. Okay. The second conclusion reached in Graziani, price equation, is in a sense similar to the fundamental equation of Keynes in his Treatise on Money, in the sense that according to equation 3, only by chance the propensity to save equals the propensity to invest. And if this is the case, no inflationary or deflationary pressure occurs. The third point of affinity with the Treatise on Money is the, and Keynes thought in general, is that Graziani maintained that the theory on the neutrality of money is clearly rejected in his model. This is an open issue in the sense that, according to Graziani, money is not neutral because it has redistributive effect. In a sense, if you come back to this equation and insert public expenditure in the aggregate demand function, since the level of employment is exogenously determined by a firm's decision, you can write G to the aggregate demand function, but these are only effects on the equilibrium price level, which means that profits increases in monetary terms. And in this sense, but only in this sense, according to Graziani, money is not neutral in the sense that it produces inflationary pressures. As regards to the links between the monetary theory of production and the general theory, there are two main links. First, Graziani considers the presence of uncertainty. And in the presence of uncertainty, according to Graziani, monetary profits of course declines. Firms react by issuing bonds, workers acquire bonds and spend the interest bill received. Here there is a counterbalancing effect, in the sense that when workers spend these money resources, this is a further source of demand. But at the same time, since firms have to pay interest on this bond, this has the counterbalancing effect, in the sense that it increases the cost of firms. Graziani maintains a continuist reading of Keynes' thought, and he maintains that monetary theory of production is a rereading of Keynes according to a line which is in line with both the monetary, with both the treatise of money and the general theory. In particular, Graziani stressed that, and this is a very controversial point, I am aware, also in the general theory, this is an argument put forward in 1988 by Basing-Moore in particular, that Keynes said have an endogenous money assumption also in the general theory. And even if this is not the case, Graziani argument, and also there is a recent paper by John Smeaton on this point, according to Graziani, Keynes is unclear on this point in the general theory. Maybe, he says, he have an endogenous money view. In some passages he doesn't have a money, an endogenous money view. When he assumes money as a given or constant, he do so because of a sort of peer pressure argument, in the sense that he wanted to communicate with his colleagues by using marginalist mathematical tools and avoiding technical financial matters, so to say. Well, our opinion is that most circuit scholars, and I personally include also Graziani, consider the Treatise on Money as the principal Keynes contribution. I think that there are few, only two, and the second is very problematic, maybe also the first. There are only two points of affinities with Keynes, but they mainly focus on Keynes' Treatise on Money, as well as his writing. The writing of Keynes, published after the general theory. The Treatise of Money is viewed as the working analyzed normal operation of a credit economy, and the general theory as the work which aims at analyze the special case of mass unemployment and crisis. Therefore, the basic schema of the monetary theory of production as presented by Graziani contains analytical elements driving from the treatise of money, namely the endogenous money view, but it basically represents, according to our opinion, a rationalization of Marx sequence money, commodity, money. Moreover, there are some unsettled questions. The first one is that if one assumes that firms obtain profits in kind and reimburse their debt in kind, there is no endogenous mechanism which ensures that the interest rate equals the monetary value of the goods firms sell to banks. Otherwise, this solution is unsatisfactory insofar a model aimed at describing the working of a credit economy generates a final condition where the monetary circuit ends as a barter economy. The second problematic question is the assumption that money wages are advanced by all firms. This is a questionable assumption on two grounds. First, from the beginning to the end of the production process, workers must live on air. If all firms advance money, and you assume as a normally a certain lag of time involving the production process, workers simply cannot consume before working. Moreover, firms pay wage without having any information of workers' labor productivity, because they advance money to workers and they have no experience on the workers' productivity, not or their human capital effort and so on. But there is a more problematic assumption. That is, in Graziani's model, banks solely finance capitalists. We should presuppose that at the beginning of the circuit, some individuals are capitalists in the sense that they are owners of the means of production. So, the problem is that the monetary circuit in the basic scheme can start only if someone is over or something. In the sense that banks finance, give credit to capitalists because they are capitalists. And in order to be capitalists, they, of course, are to be owner of production, or means of production, or monetary resources. In other words, the main critical point, according to our view, is that the monetary circuit can start only if past variables are taken into account. Or, in other words, it is, in our view, but it is unrealistic, but is also illogical to assume that an economy starts with sole credit creation. Well, this is a crucial point in the sense that the basic scheme of Graziani closes with whatever level of employment. Since variation of the level of employment solely determine variation of firms' debt over banks. In this sense, Graziani's model does not focus on the determination of the level of employment. Its only focus on the creation of money and the end of the circuit. In other words, it only aims at finding the conditions which allow the closure of the circuit, meaning the closure of the circuit, a condition where firms are in the position to repay their debt to banks. Therefore, once the paradox, the so-called paradox of profits, is overcome in our view, according to both a realistic argument, in the sense, I repeat, I cannot imagine an economy which will start now without history, and on the logical plane, because you must assume that someone has something. If one removes this problem, then the focus can shift to more, according to our view, to more realistic problem. And therefore you can, and this is our first attempt in this paper, to move within an integration between the monetary theory of production or its basic elements and the basic elements of the general theory. Now I will present an exercise. This is not a novel model in the sense that it presents new theses or original theses. This is an attempt to insert, to contaminate the monetary theory of production, some basic assumption, and the fundamental assumption or thesis of the general theory. In so doing, we concentrate on the following issues. We first try to show that the so-called paradox of profits holds only on the condition that the economic process starts with money creation in the absence of an accumulated stock of wealth. Second, we try to show that a monetary economy with a deregulated labor market does not automatically generate a full employment equilibrium. And third, expansionary fiscal policy are required in order not to produce the closure of the circuit, but to increase the employment rate. These are the assumptions we consider to sector economy. At the beginning of the production process, capitalists own a disposable income deriving from profits made in the previous production process. It is assumed that firms finance the production of consumer investment goods according to a channel of financing, the so-called picking order theory, that we extract from issuing bonds. The first finance production and investment via internal retention, after they contract debt to banks. This is an important assumption according to us, which is that public public expenditure has positive effects on firms' aggregate money profits, but because they modify expectations of firms, especially of firms operating on domestic markets, and because, according to the basic scheme, public expenditure increases profits, and this allows firms, is a permissive condition for firms to self-financing production and investments. These are the symbols we use. The paradox of profit is simply, according to this, our assumption that capitalists own an initial disposable income, is simply solved by equation B1, in the sense that capitalists pay workers the side amount of investment and finance investment not only on the basis of credit creation, but also on the basis of their internal retention. Therefore, what the debt of firms toward banks is necessarily lower than their revenues. In this sense, it is sufficient to admit that firms have a previous profit to spend to solve the paradox. Once solved the paradox, you can explore the path of employment, and the basic results are this. First, of course, firms, given the order channel in financing, they first spend their resources to pay workers, and then they go in debt toward the banking system. And the condition is, of course, that the expected rate of profits must be higher than the interest rate in order for finance to be positive, to the demand of credit to be positive. This is the basic, the familiar aggregate demand function, so that profits are now equal, are now positive, because firms are in a position to gain from their consumption, CK, plus their investment. This allowed them to repay in money, banks. As regard to employment, you can see from the aggregate demand function, more in detail, of course, in paper, that the level of employment is higher. The higher is capitalist consumption. We make reference to an institutional Veblenian argument regarding ostentation and emulation within the capital, the class of capitalists. Employment is higher, the higher is the propensity to invest, the higher is the money wage bill, the higher the workers' propensity to consume. Not that labor market deregulation, but this is another paper, in other words, labor market deregulation, insofar as it increases uncertainty because of higher job insecurity, reduce the present propensity to consume, thus negatively affecting the level of employment. In line with the basic principle of the monetary theory of production, the level of employment ultimately depends on firms' demand for credit, both for production and investment purpose. This is because high levels of firm's indebtedness implies high level of wages, of the money wage bill in both sectors, and high demand for investment derived from firms operating that sector. Furthermore, for a given level of firms' indebtedness, employment grows as capitalist expenditure increases, which in turn depends on their accumulated wealth. So the main message is that the level of employment is that the labor market is a residual market, in the sense that the level of employment basically depend on the dynamics of the credit market. This is our preliminary attempt to integrate the monetary theory of production and the general theory. While the basic sequence, the familiar sequence, is aggregate demand employment, by inserting this element of the monetary theory production, you see that the degree of banks' accommodation, that is credit restriction and so on, the dynamics of the credit market affect the path of aggregate demand, and the path of aggregate demand affect the path of employment. So the relevant question, and I finish, is to explore the dynamics of the credit market. We do so in the paper. I go very fast now. If you agree that unemployment ultimately depends on the level of employment, ultimately depends on the credit market dynamics, the credit market can be in equilibrium with unemployment. So you have credit market equilibrium in the sense that credit supply equals a credit demand. You can have equilibrium in the market for goods. We can have disequilibrium in the labor market. But moreover, you can have disequilibrium in the credit market, which depends not only on factors relating to credit supply, credit restriction. There are a number of papers of credit rationing related to uncertainty on the part of banks. We also assume that credit restriction ultimately depends on restrictive fiscal policies, in the sense that if you reduce public expenditure or increase taxation, you reduce aggregate demand, reduce firms' profits according to our assumption, firms' expectations, and also banks' expectations. Not also that there is no endogenous mechanism which ensures that the rate of profits expected by firms equals the rate of profits expected by banks. But more interesting, according to me, at least in Italy, is the dynamic of the demand for credit, in the sense that firms can reduce, and the Bank of Italy has produced a lot of research in this year. The demand for credit reduces. Why? There are basically two reasons. First, the necessity to go in debt. In a phase with characterized by a decline of aggregate demand of employment, firms need lower cash, lower credit to pay wages. There is also a factor of convenience to go in debt, in the sense that the decision to go in debt can be conceived as a strategy of firms, since credit, of course, is a cost of firms. By minimizing the demand for credit, the firms in competition to stay competitive can minimize the demand for credit, thus allowing on the microeconomic plane to expect to reduce total cost and to expect higher profits for the individual firms, while generating on the aggregate demand on the aggregate plane, on the macroeconomic plane, a decline of aggregate demand. I finish with fiscal policy. Assume that public expenditure falls according to our attempt to integrate these two approaches. This generates two effects. First, for the assumption of complementarity between public expenditure and profits, this generates a decline of current profits. Second, it determines the reduction of capitalist consumption for a given financing of investment. Second, it increases the interest rate. We are now exploring this issue also on empirical ground, and at least in Italy it seems that the story is this, in the sense that contrary to the standard ISLM model, a reduction of public expenditure does not produce a reduction of interest rate, but it can produce an increase of the interest rate according to this trivial schema. If public expenditure reduces, this implies a reduction of firms' profits. For given expectations, the bargaining power of banks increases. Then banks can increase the interest rate, or they reduce alpha, which is the degree of their accommodation or other services related to credit supply. Then the burden of debt increases, thus reduce net profits, investment, and employment. I finish saying that according to this sequence, which must be explored also on the empirical ground, not only the standard ISLM model does not work in its basic view, but the main message is the restrictive fiscal policies redistribute income from wages and profits to financial rents, and particularly to banks. Sorry for the delay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Guglielmo. I've been intrigued for some time about the relationship between the monetary circuit approach and the economics of Keynes, but have never had the opportunity to explore the literature. So I'm therefore most grateful to Guglielmo and Rosario for setting out a clear analysis of the essence of circuit theory and the possible connections with Keynes's treatise and general theory. Their analysis has largely confirmed my reservations and misgivings. I'm not familiar with the state of Italian economics, though I understand that Graziani is no doubt deservedly held in high esteem. But I sense that Guglielmo is attempting, for whatever reasons, to create a synthesis between Graziani and Keynes, which is not really possible. Let's begin with the distinction between the barter and monetary economies. Much has been made of the parallel between, on the one hand, Keynes's distinctions in his early drafts of the general theory between cooperative neutral, and monetary economy, and on the other hand, or entrepreneur economy, he called it initially, and on the other hand, Marx's distinction between the CMC, pure commodity production economy, and the capitalist MCM prime version. And it's the latter that appears to be at the heart of the monetary circuit approach. And Claudio Sardoni gave a very interesting talk to this seminar on, I shudder to say, the 5th of November 2008, on the relationship between the thinking of Marx and Keynes, which I think shed some light on this and which you can still listen to on the website. That's the advantage of this little box. The crux of the matter seems to me the focus of circuit theory on the role of money as means of payment, as opposed to money as unit of account, putting it at a very abstract level. When Keynes discusses a monetary economy, I believe he is focusing on the latter aspect rather than the former. That is to say, for Keynes, a monetary economy is defined by the need to arrange contracts for production and exchange for value in terms of money. It is, of course, true that the dominant role of money as unit of account is all bound up with its role as the ultimate means of settlement of debts. And Geoffrey Ingham has written magisterially on this in his book, The Nature of Money, and I think Robin Latimer has made a few thoughts in this direction. Yet, the actual cash flows, the payments of money, are not important in Keynes. What matters are two things. First, the distinction between money and real wages, and second, the properties of money as a store of value. And the distinction between money and real wages is fundamental to Keynes's principle of effective demand and his break with the Ricardian conception of equilibrium, and indeed his own earlier work in the Treatise on Money. Furthermore, there is no finance constraint in the general theory. Investment decisions are governed by the rate of interest and in turn by liquidity preference, but this has nothing to do with banks or financing mechanisms. Keynes largely assumes free competition, except for the brief discussion of borrowers and lenders risk, which seeded both Minsky's work and the credit rationing literature. Now, Alain Pargues once told me that Keynes's theory of liquidity preference is a mess, and I confess that that put me on guard. Alain's view seems to be related to the myth the recognition that bank money is endogenous is somehow a great breakthrough, at least in Keynesian circles. Keynes fully understood that banks create money by making loans. The key point in the general theory is the independence of banking policy, as Keynes calls it, from production decisions. It's the polar opposite of the monetary circuit approach. For Keynes, the banking system is not simply a servant of industry, if only it were. There is a confusion in the endogenous money literature between unlimited access to banking reserves from the central bank and unlimited access to capital. The importance of this difference has been brought forcibly home by our recent experience of the banking crisis. The fact that the central bank targets interest rates and accommodates the demand for reserves accordingly tells us very little about the willingness of the banking system to lend for production. Banking policy is currently dominated by concerns about profitability and capital, and governments are finding it very difficult to make banks lend for production. I've often said that economists should take a preliminary course in accounting. Kenneth Boulding once wrote, and I've translated from the American, that the income and expense concepts, which are essentially value aggregates of additions to and subtractions from the total stock of assets, must be distinguished clearly from the receipts and payments concepts. Receipts consist of the additions to liquid assets or money. Payments consist of the subtractions from liquid assets or money. It is hardly any exaggeration to say that the failure to distinguish clearly between receipts and income on the one hand and between payments and consumption on the other has been the source of most of the confusion in economics, and especially in macroeconomics, in the past generation. I think this confusion still exists in both mainstream and some post-Keynesian thought, although the issue is now being recognised in the latter case under the rubric of stock flow consistent modelling. I raise this point because it makes it clear that bank finance is at the level of the aggregate neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for production. As Guglielmo recognises, it is quite possible for firms to hold cash and to use it to finance working capital independently of the banks. Trade credit and cash advances from customers are extremely important in practice. The Tesco supermarket chain has financed its growth almost entirely with trade credit from its suppliers. Of course, a decision to produce or invest requires finance. But in Keynes's system, there is nothing special or necessary about banks, except insofar as they create money to relieve a shortage of liquidity, something that looks very similar to credit, but is actually quite different. When I say bank finance is not sufficient, I mean that banks can and do create money quite independently of the provision of finance for production. Indeed, the Bank of England was founded to create money by the purchase of a government bond to finance a war. The quantity of money depends on banking portfolios as a whole, which consist of government bonds and bills, as well as commercial bills purchased in the secondary market, without any reference to production. There is simply no automatic connection at the level of theory, which is what we're talking about, between the banking system and the level of employment. Not that I'm suggesting banks are unimportant, far from it, merely that their influence comes through other channels. Thus, in Boulding's terms, circuit theory confuses income with money receipts and describes a very particular set of circumstances in which firms, mainly smaller ones, depend on banks for working capital. The paradox of profits owes more to Marx and his realisation problem than to Keynes. Let me refer you once again to Sardoni. It seems to me that there's nothing in circuit theory that has not been covered by Kolesky's version of the principle of effective demand, augmented by Minsky's explicit treatment of the financial sector, from which, of course, Keynes abstracts in the general theory. So the claim to a genuine foundation in Keynes is as dubious as that of the similar claim made by the new Keynesians. Let me give you some specific examples. We read that circuit theory proponents regard the general theory as a special case of the treatise. This contradicts Keynes's own words and fails to appreciate the significance of Keynes's core idea of the point of effective demand as the equilibrium position of a monetary economy, the centrepiece of the general theory and the key break with tradition, including his own previous self. In particular, the idea that the repayment of bank debts is a condition of equilibrium is totally alien to Keynes. Secondly, the idea of a sequential economy is fraught with problems of time periods. And again, Keynes deliberately rejected this method in favour of the static model of the general theory. This is not to deny that there are some formal dynamics in the general theory, but these are to do with a long period adjustment of the capital stock to a given state of expectation in a process of continuous short period equilibrium. There's no room in Keynes for ex ante, ex post, and all that Hicksian Swedish stuff. Although I applaud Guglielmo's attempt to introduce uncertainty into the circuit model, I do not think the importance of uncertainty is that it leads to transaction demand for money, nor do you, I think. But it's not, as Graziani suggests, the need for transaction demand for money or to hoarding by workers, if you like, or in Marxian terms, a failure to realise the surplus. For Keynes, hoarding is the wrong question and has no meaning at the aggregate level. It is the propensity to hoard that matters. Fourthly, there is of course no serious supply side or theory of value in circuit theory, and certainly there's nothing in common with Keynes's Marshallian theory of value and the firm. I agree entirely with Guglielmo that firms must have a clear idea of labour productivity in order to maximise their expected profits. This is taken for granted by Keynes. Whether workers have a clear idea of the real value of their money wage is an entirely different matter and not very important to Keynes. The idea that it is important owes more to Pigou and the so-called New Keynesians. Fifthly, it appears there's no theory of long-term investment in circuit theory, no reference to the marginal efficiency of capital, and a distinction is introduced between the rate of profit and the rate of interest, which does not exist in Keynes. And as mentioned earlier in the context of endogenous money, there appears to be in circuit theory only the short-term policy rate of interest, and no treatment of the long rate on bonds, no room for liquidity preference. So in conclusion, I admit that I am not greatly impressed by circuit theory, and still less by the claim that it has something to do with Keynes. Guglielmo and Rosario know Keynes's work too well not to recognise the weaknesses of the basic Graziani schema, and have worked hard, for reasons I don't fully understand, to develop a version of circuit theory that can be called genuinely Keynesian. But I don't think it can be done for the reasons that I've outlined.